welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavy Cast, episode 91, I think. And this week we don't have Eden, because of course, when can we ever have a regular episode these days? But instead we have Simon, as in Simon Handmaker, our fellow editor. Hello, Simon.
Hey, I'm the other bullshit philosopher on the editing team.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, since this is probably the first time the podcast. Well, you were technically in the New York episode, but that episode was a shit show of audio quality, so that no one probably listened to that.
Yeah, and I don't know why anyone would if they did. What do you want? Just like basic information?
Or? Whatever, dude. Just tell me your favorite meme if that's what you want to do.
I'm 5'6". I wear size 9 shoes. And I mostly listen to black metal, sludge metal, and math rock these days.
Basically white supremacy music.
Yeah, exactly. And black metal.
Okay, well, that's good enough, I guess.
Yeah.
God damn it. What I don't know why, but I wanted to complain about, like, today, this morning, I was Skyping with my parents, as, like, we Skype every week at 11 a.m. on Sundays, right?
And oh,
but
nice.
Like they call me at 10:45, and I'm like, why? Because, like, you know, I engineer my entire day around that, so like them calling early is actually super inconvenient. But then they call and I just decline, right? Because, you know, I'll just get back to it in 15 minutes. But then they call again and I decline, and then my dad texts me Skype, and I'm like, dude, and like he messages me on Facebook, and then he calls me again. Like, I know that back in the day, before smartphones, like, to reach someone, you would have to, like, keep calling them until you, like, hit, right? Like, until you kind of reach them. But, like, in the day of smartphones, like,
there's no reason for that.
Yeah, notifications exist. And my dad knows this, but, like, every time they try to reach me, they'll always, like, keep calling me until I respond, which is just, like, really frustrating. I mean, it's not a big deal, but
old habits die hard.
Yeah, pretty much. Just like old people.
Yeah, just like Bruce Willis.
Or, yeah, what? Why?
Because Die Hard. Anyway. Right, that set the tone for the episode,
yes,
right there.
Exactly. So speaking of things dying hard, we have some Spotify news that we want to talk about.
Not the direction I thought you were going to go in. Holy shit.
Well, that's how we work here, man. We kind of... underhandly, wow, whatever. I don't fucking. Anyway, Spotify.
The segues are just Audible.
Yeah. Audibletrial.com/heavy. That's the segue. If you want to support the podcast, you can go there and. Okay. Man, you're really sandbagging me here. Anyway, so there's this article that came out a couple weeks ago, actually, but we just got around to it, from Music Business Worldwide. This is the website that did the whole story about, like, Spotify creating fake artists to kind of inflate their numbers. You remember that one?
Yeah. We talked about that.
Yeah, so the same site put out an article saying, like, here's what Spotify needs to do if it needs to be profitable. And but it was like five or six items, basically. Three. Wow, I can't count. Three items, but basically the one was watch the pennies, aka they are just being very loose with their money, apparently. Like, they're, despite making more money and paying less royalties, they still are kind of being loose with their money, and they need to kind of get rid of the free option or make it more profitable, essentially. Like, you know, the ad-supported free option. And obviously that's going to upset a lot of people, because that's, like, probably the most common use case for Spotify.
I mean, yeah, that's kind of the big pull, is that you have so much music available at no cost.
And if it becomes, like, too ad-riddled, then people will just not want to use it. So that's, like, a catch-22 there. Secondly, increase worldwide sales, especially outside of the USA. Like, they have some charts here, and shows that, like, 40% of their revenue is in the USA. 10% is in the UK. Sorry, 11%. And 7% is in Sweden. And 41% is in the rest of the world. And the rest of the world pie has been shrinking every year. So... basically, outside of USA and UK and Sweden, they need to kind of grow their business, because, like, it is true that if you go in other places in the world, like in Turkey, for example, Spotify is non-existent. Like, obviously it exists, but not a lot of people use it. Like, yeah. And presumably part of that is due to, like, rights licensing and stuff. Like, it's probably not trivial to get worldwide licenses for all kinds of music, but I mean, you know, it's their job to solve this problem. So,
yeah, like it's, you know, you can't, they can't really just claim like, well, that's too difficult. Like, cause it's like, well, that's literally what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And like, if you want to succeed, then you have to do it. Especially yeah. like Japan and Germany are very like physical media oriented countries. Japan like has a really strong secondhand physical sales industry. So like penetrating that is important for them, like because Japan listens to a lot of music, but they are also very like reliant on physical music. So yeah, just you can't just rely on the USA. And finally, basically average subscriber spend is decreasing, which means I guess again the amount of
people on the free tier are increasing faster than
yes
people
exactly.
on the other tier.
And last week's we discussed that like every time they acquire a new customer, they lose money, which is not a good business model to have.
That's a very bad business model to have. That's the opposite of what you want.
So, yeah, essentially they're, like, we keep saying this basically every week at this point. Like, they're between a rock and a hard place, and they need to kind of figure things out. And they still need to do their public offering later this year. Like, you know, they're going public with their stocks. And that's probably going to require that they make some changes as well, but like it's a hard problem to solve. Like we saw SoundCloud got fucked and then kind of maybe got unfucked by Chance the Rapper, but not really. Pandora is closing down his business in Australia and New Zealand, and Tidal is Tidal. So
yeah,
and Apple Music is succeeding because Apple has a huge like war chest of money and they can just absorb all the costs.
Exactly. Yeah, that's like the thing is and same with Amazon Prime. And yeah. its music, you know, it's not nearly as much of a competitor at this point, but, you know, Amazon yeah. can just, like, absorb any costs as if it's, like, just absolutely nothing.
Yeah, and Google, too, if they ever decide to go into
exactly.
this.
Exactly. I heard that Spotify is actually renegotiating their deal with Warner Music.
Hmm.
And is trying to get Warner Music to agree to go down from, I think, a 55% royalty to a 52% royalty, but what they asked is I think I heard it was from like an undisclosed source.
Mm-hmm.
That and not obviously my undisclosed source, but it was like an article I read.
yeah,
I have people on the inside. What they said was that Warner basically will agree to go down to like a 52 or 53% cut from the royalties. As opposed to, you know, 55, on the condition that Spotify stop doing the thing where they bloat their playlists with unknown or anonymous artists.
So, you know what I discovered?
So, that might even actually put Spotify in a tougher position if they take that.
Yeah, because then
they
have to be
pay out way more royalties.
Yeah, they need to be more honest with their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So, on that note, I discovered something, like, yeah, and this is going to segue into another news item right now. But, you know, I was looking for, there was a, yeah, like Faceless played their first show of the new Summer Slaughter tour like yesterday, right? And we'll talk about the Faceless in a second. But basically, I was looking for footage of this, right? Like, I immediately went to YouTube and like searched for the Faceless and limited to like last week, right? And turns out that there's like all kinds of channels that upload fake live videos. Like they have a photo of like a generic live show, not even of the Faceless, right? Just like a light show and like some audience. And it's like 40 minutes long. And when you click on the video, it just plays some like generic music and says to watch this, blah, blah, blah. Just click the download link in the description. And there's like hundreds of this, like for every Summer Slaughter date of every Summer Slaughter band, they've already automatically generated and uploaded videos.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. Like, what the fuck? And, like, it's all fake videos. And, like, you can... I just did a little bit of digging. You can do this for, like, any major tour, and you will find these fake videos there. And it's kind of really messed up. I mean, presumably, people... this is just to get people to, like me to accidentally click on them. And then when you do, they get the ad revenue. And if someone is, like, naive enough to click the download link, then they just probably get some malware or whatever. Like, this is just bullshit.
I'm not surprised,
yeah.
But I'm surprised at the amount of, you know, someone's obviously dedicated to doing this if they're, like, spamming stuff for every tour.
Yeah.
And spamming stuff for, you know, every band on Summer Slaughter. But that's, like, That's not super surprising.
I mean, presumably it's automated at this point. Like,
I'm sure it's automated, but someone has to put in the effort.
Yeah.
To set up the automated system.
Yeah, sure. And like, man, this system of like fake content on streaming services, I think is just going to keep growing and growing until it becomes like a really big. And the thing is, like, this is just wasting server space on Google's end. Mm-hmm. Like, but if they make more ad money from this, then it costs to host that. Then I guess it works for Google too. So maybe they don't.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, Google probably would spend more devoting manpower to fixing this problem.
Yeah,
than they,
for sure.
Like, you know, would spend in server space of just letting this be a thing.
Yeah. So talking about the faceless. The faceless have kind of been a shit show for a while, unfortunately. Like, I don't want to go into like unsubstantiated rumors, but basically the band were like, you know, dropping out of tours, losing members, and like losing gear and stuff, and constantly missing tours. And finally, they made the first stop of their Summer Slaughter tour with a new drummer. Well,
no, they made the second stop.
I mean,
of the Summer Slaughter
their
tour.
First, like, they,
oh yeah, it was their first stop.
They missed the first.
They missed the
stop.
First date.
Yeah, because they blamed their drummer, and the drummer was like, nah, dude, that's not what happened.
They had a month to figure something out.
Yeah, but now they have the former Native Construct drummer James Norrell, who's also in Dan's project, The Omega Experiment, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And
James is an amazing drummer. And
he's great.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of... One thing that I will say in the Faceless's favor, even if, you know, obviously... Or I guess not obviously, but, you know, it looks as though they're lying about not having the time to find a replacement drummer.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty feasible. If I remember correctly, that them and James wouldn't have any time to practice because, you know, without... I remember, you know, seeing something James... We're friends on Facebook, and I think he lives somewhere in the, like, the central area of the country, like, not near California where the rest of the band is located at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's still feasible to some extent that they wouldn't have been able to practice.
And it's not like their material is trivial. And even if the drummer like has all the material down on point, you still would prefer to be able to practice together to like make sure everything's in sync. Because like, not only do you have like guitars and vocals, you also have like samples, and you like you really want to make sure everything is coordinated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like you said, their music's not trivial. You know, they're not like, you know, the most complex. They're not Brain Drill. By any means, or like Archspire, but you know, their music has a lot going on, and because of that, it's like, you know, it's something where you need to have everyone together in a space working out all the kinks before you can kind of put it on in a live venue.
And like, of course, they had some issues during their first live show with this new lineup, but that's to be expected, right? Like, they didn't play their most exciting songs and they had technical difficulties, but that's normal for what they're going through. Now, whether they're going through is, you know, as the band says or not, is disputable, obviously, but it is, like, so apparently, according to the drummer's statement, like, the band making the tour was contingent on them delivering the album to Sumerian. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
And apparently they did deliver an album to Sumerian, even though it doesn't have a title or artwork yet, which is kind of makes it sound a little rushed, but hey.
And Sumerian, also the Spiraling Void maybe isn't on it, which is weird because that song was way better than Black Star.
I actually came to like Black Star more. Like, Black Star's drum production is bad, but Black Star's... I don't know, Spiraling Void feels like too long for what it is, and it's kind of like a bit more generic, whereas Black Star kind of has more of an Opeth-y vibe, I guess, and maybe I miss Opeth being Opeth too much.
I think what Blackstar kind of rubbed me the wrong way about Blackstar, and this is like a really weird and specific complaint, is that I feel like I've heard one of the melodies in like every other technical death metal song, and it's like that like that kind of off time arpeggiated chord.
I mean,
and it's
Faceless
just like
kind of
that,
created
like,
that sound.
They did create that, but you know, they created that how many years ago now?
Nine.
Yeah, like it's been 9 years, so yeah, you know, move on.
Yeah.
But it's still not a bad song by any means.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, like despite all this shit happening, we still want the band to succeed, right? Like Akeldama and Planetary Duality are like amazing albums, and Autotheism was pretty cool too, and especially in like some songs. So like, you know, I wish the band could like get over their problems, whatever is plaguing them, and like, you know, be stable. But you know,
And Ken Sorceron and Justin McKinney are both, you know, amazing musicians in their own right.
Yeah, yeah. Ken Sorceron from Abigail Williams is on vocals, and Justin McKinney from the Faceless 2.0 is on guitars.
Yeah, and, you know, they're both, like, insanely talented and have their own amazing projects. And so I don't really, like, it's kind of unclear what's holding them back. There's, like, you know, the rumors that are flying around. But, you know, it is not for the lack of talent that these guys are, you know, missing dates and missing tours and whatnot. So clearly, like, something is afoot, and hopefully they can work it out.
Yeah, for sure. So along the lines of, I guess, involving Tech Death, have you heard the new Cytotoxin album?
You know, I haven't had a chance to listen to it in full yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I did listen to about, I think, the first four or five songs from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think okay, so the music itself is good.
Yeah.
But what really blew me away is the fact that this is on Unique Leader. Because it sounds nothing like anything else on Unique Leader.
Yeah. It sounds like closest to Brain Drill, I would say. With Brain Drill, more deathcore.
There's a lot of deathcore in it. Brain Drill or Archspire.
Yeah.
Like, there's a very similar vibe to both of the Archfire singles that I found in terms of kind of the back and forth between these kind of, like, chug-heavy riffs
mm-hmm.
and these, like, crazy tap-sweeped whatever sections.
Yeah. So, I mean, I listened to the whole album, obviously, like, many times. I really like it, but it doesn't necessarily stick with me so much, like, except for a few moments in a few songs. But it's, like, mm-hmm. a really good listening experience, so I'm happy with it. And, like, contrary to Rings of Saturn's new album, which came out this week, I think, like, I don't really love that album, unfortunately. I you know, I'm less harsh on Rings of Saturn than most. Like, I like Dingir. And I like their debut and, their stupid album is Lugalkian. That's okay. But I really didn't like this new one because it's like too much chugging and it kind of takes away the energy from the riffs at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I listened to some of it. The thing is I've been out of town for like 10 days now
mm-hmm.
And I just got back today. So, you know, new music has not really not a lot of new music has passed through my ears.
Mm-hmm.
As of, you know, late. And what I heard, I kind of thought really did not strike the right balance.
Yeah, exactly.
Between, you know, the technical stuff and the more deathcore chug-heavy stuff. And what they've been good at up until this point, and, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Lugalkian, but I did like the debut a lot, and I liked Dingir a lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were good at was kind of balancing out those two sides of their formula, but it seems like here, I don't know if it's just laziness or losing their mojo or what.
Like the chugs just take
it
away.
It seems like they detract from each other now.
Yeah, exactly. The chugging parts just take away too much momentum from the song. Like they are just too slow. Like I get that they're trying to be like ironic and heavy, but it just doesn't work as a song. Like it feels like every section is written kind of in a sense that let's take this part and let's try to make it stand out, but it doesn't kind of connect together.
Yeah, I mean, if everything is supposed to stand out, then none of it's going to fit into whatever is around it.
Yep. So that's that. But we have some other tech stuff as well. So there's a new Contrarian album.
Which is incredibly good.
I couldn't really get into this so far. Like, to be fair, I haven't really given it too much of a chance. But let's go over it for a second. Contrarian is a, I guess, how you would describe it, like, progressive death metal band,
like old school progressive death metal. Yeah. Like the other artists they invoke most are definitely like early Cynic and Atheist.
Yeah, and in the band is George Colias, drummer of Nile, and the dude from Mithras, I believe, mm-hmm. is in the band at some capacity, and a few other people from like less prolific bands, but still like mm-hmm. talented people. But,
yeah, still, you know, it's a band with a very good pedigree.
And this is their second album, To Perceive is to Suffer. And like you said, it is very Atheist / Old Cynic, like, even down to the production, which mm-hmm. may be divisive for some. My biggest problem with it was probably the vocals.
that, yeah, it took me a while to get past the sound of the vocals, but once I kind of just accepted that that's the way they were, I found a lot to enjoy in not so much the vocals themselves, but in the instrumentals in a way that the vocals didn't really detract from.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can see why they'd be an issue for someone who kind of focuses on them more.
I don't necessarily focus on them more. It's just that they're weirdly grating, but I believe I can go with, yeah. I just haven't had a lot of time to listen to it, but I do like that every song is like 3 or 4 minutes. So it's mm-hmm. like,
yeah, it's an 8-song album. It's only 34 minutes, which is, you know, pretty, I don't want to say unheard of in technical death metal, but that's definitely something that like goes back to, you know, focus or unquestionable presence.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, focus is like what, 35 minutes and unquestionable presence is somewhere around 35 to 40. Like, I don't know. I'm a bigger fan of short albums when it comes to more extreme forms of metal. Well, when it comes to death metal, I'm a bigger fan of short albums than of like incredibly overlong albums.
Like mine.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. But I feel also, you know, yours is, it's like once you've leaned into that enough,
yeah,
that it's kind of,
and it kind of just the way it is, like got out of my hands. Like mm-hmm. I kept thinking that it was too short, and then suddenly I had like an hour of material, and like, what the fuck happened here?
Yeah, it's a. Like there's so much going on Entropy that it kind of is. It's very acceptable for it to be as long as it is.
And by the way, self plug: the album comes out in like less than 2 weeks on the 11th.
August 11th, yeah.
And I have like 2 new singles out, like The Hallway, which features Christian Musner of like Obscura and every other tech death band ever, and Maelstrom Gate Part 2 with, wow, I'm so unenthusiastic about this. Brandon from Sense of Gravity. No, I'm unenthusiastic.
I'm putting out an album.
I'm just tired of the whole thing, right? It just takes a lot of effort to make all these videos and like engage in all the marketing, and like it's just really tiresome. Like, I just don't want to hear the album anymore at this point, which is like,
do you want me to plug it for you right now?
No, we're good.
Okay.
One thing though, I am trying to get another video done, for Omnipotence Paradox, featuring Hayato and CJ. They've sent me their video files. I just need to like do my own part and finish it up. It's gonna be pretty cool. I'm pretty happy with what they've sent me. So yeah. So I guess moving on from Contrarian, unless you have something else to add.
One thing that I found, one other observation I have about it is, especially towards the end of the album, there were some touches that felt really gore gutsy and kind of modern gore gutsy, not, you know, classic brutal death metal and Obscura gore gutsy. And some sections that felt really, really reminiscent of Colored Sands in a really good way. And so I think that kind of speaks to what I think is a strength of Contrarians in terms of the way they've taken very classic aspects and very classic sounds within tech death as a genre, going back to, you know, some of the earliest albums, and really updated it in a sense and kind of brought it forwards instead of just trying to emulate what was already done. And so, yeah, shout out to them for that, because more bands, especially in death metal right now, more bands need to focus on taking what their influences did and bringing it into the present instead of just trying to stick with what's already been done.
And bringing it to present doesn't necessarily mean just do it with like more modern, air quotes, production. Like, I just actually really hate super modern production in death metal.
Same. I think there are times when I'm okay with it, but by and large, I vastly prefer older stuff. And older stuff or like rawer stuff, because it sounds more befitting of the music than kind of this hyper produced.
I can't tolerate
stuff.
I can't listen to Zenith Passage because of the production. It's just too much for me. I would much rather listen to some band from like Canada, for example, even though like that's very nebulous. Like there's a style to that, usually to that sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So moving on, another progressive thing, there's a new Neoblivascaris song and album announcement.
Yes, there is.
So I believe the album is going to be called Urn, which is kind of goofy. And more goofy is the song title, which is Intravenous, but as in intra space Venus the planet, which I don't fucking know, man. But they have Robin from Cynic on bass. So they don't have an abuser in the band anymore. That's nice.
That's good.
But I really like this song. I don't know if you got a chance to listen to it.
Yeah, I've listened to it a couple times now.
So I was on board with Neo Blaviskar's way back, like before they became a big deal. Like I found them through some like underground site and I was like, wow, this is super cool. But like the more material they put out, the less I started to like them because kind of the songs felt kind of tedious and overindulgent. And I never was able to get into Citadel, I believe. But this one sounds like a really good balance for me in terms of kind of having a long song and like slower parts, but also kind of keeping the energy going. I'm actually really happy with this song.
I think the problem is that Neo Blaviskar is a weird band because they exist at the intersection of like a lot of different things. And they're kind of very much a hybrid. They're very much a hybrid of different sounds.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say I disliked the song. I thought it was, you know, pretty acceptable, especially for a first single. And that sounds, you know, demeaning in some way. But like, I liked it for what it was, but I'm not particularly excited for the album, just because they're clearly going in a much more like Opethy and like prog direction.
Yeah.
And what I always liked was kind of the black metal was at the forefront on their debut.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because they had this black metal, but they really tempered it with a lot of progressive influences, as opposed to now where they've got progressive metal, but they temper it with a lot of extreme metal influences.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's good. And I probably like that song. The more I kind of reflect on it and, you know, having listened to it multiple times now, it's definitely something I would rather listen to than just about anything off of Citadel.
Yeah.
Because I agree in terms of Citadel being very, very overindulgent, but I don't have high hopes for Urn being an album I enjoy through and through.
Probably not.
Especially as much as I enjoyed Portal of Eye.
Yeah, so this is, looking at the album track list, Urn is like 6 songs. The first 2 songs are like part 1, part 2, then Intravenous, then an 11-minute song, then another Urn part 1, Urn part 2 song.
Nice.
45 minutes total.
That's really not bad. Wow.
Yeah. So like 9 minutes, 2 minutes, 7 minutes, 11 minutes, 7 minutes, 6 minutes are the track lengths.
That's really
fine.
Good. Yeah, that's perfect.
I also like the production on this one more than what they've done previously. Like it kind of sounds more pristine, I guess. Like you said, like because the band is an intersection of like this Opeth sound, this black metal sound, this death metal sound, and like this violin driven like gothic metal sound. And depending on where they lean in on that like Venn diagram, it can easily kind of alienate other groups of listeners, but for me, like this seems like the right direction to go, and the production kind of highlights it as a more progressive sound as well. Well, yeah, so I'm interested. I'm not like super on board. I really like the idea of Blaviskar's, but I never end up liking what they do too much. So hopefully this one will be kind of live up to my image of the band, I guess.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, I mean, that pretty much sums up how I feel as well in terms of, you know, that plus my thoughts from earlier.
So in other news of black metal-ish things, there's a new Mirkur song.
Yes, there is.
And I'm, as I always, very excited about this. It's called Olvind, I believe. I don't know how the fuck to pronounce it. This has been an issue of
contention. I think it's Olvind?
I guess.
That's just the chorus, isn't it? Is her saying like, Olvind! That's how it sounds.
Now I want you to cover all of her discography.
I'm gonna have to. Yeah.
I really like the video for this one. Like, I mean, it's pretty generic, like Scandinavian imagery plus like you know, women in woods and whatnot, but it's like shot and color corrected very well, so it works really nicely. But also I really like the song. So like I didn't like the previous single as much, Manneblut or whatever, how the fuck you pronounce that. But this one feels more diverse and kind of like more what I want to see from Mirkur. So I'm really happy and interested in seeing how this album pans out.
I always feel like a bit of an asshole for saying this because it makes me sound like a black metal elitist, but I'm not really a fan of Mirkur. I don't know what it is necessarily. As far as black metal goes, you know, my tastes tend to be more in the either Cascadian stuff uh-huh. or the really, really, really weird out there stuff. So, you know, either like Wolves of the Throne Room or Jukegite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Mirkur never really, I guess, sat well with me. Not in any way where I was like, oh, you know, this sucks. This isn't true black metal because I'm not that kind of person. But just in a way where it didn't really appeal to me. But I really, really enjoyed Ulwind. And I feel like I need to go revisit her previous works now with, you know, Ulwind in mind and kind of see if I can, you know, access them better now that I've found a song that I like by her.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm generally, my favorite type of black metal is either the kind of theatrically avant-garde or the, like, enslaved Borknagar, Vintersorg style kind of progressive folk sound. Mm-hmm. And this kind of leans more towards that, which is why I like it. And plus has some like atmospheric qualities as well. So yeah, I'm into this and I'm excited for the album.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said you like Wolves in the Throne Room more. Well, I have just the thing for you. Well, I don't, the band does, but yeah, there's a new Wolves in the Throne Room song.
Oh my God. I know. It's, I'm so excited. September 22nd is my Christmas. I love this band so much. Wolves in the Throne Room is like, you know, they're one of my favorite bands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their last two albums, Celestial Lineage and Celestite, haven't been my favorites that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
I felt they were kind of too heavy on the synths and kind of a little bit too up their own ass. Which, you know, if you read kind of their descriptions,
yeah,
as far as their music goes, like, you can kind of get where I'm coming from with that. But I felt like they kind of leaned a little bit too far into their more gimmicky side.
Mm-hmm.
But the new song, I think, is a really, really good pull away from that. And it kind of combines everything that I love about their first three albums with some of the things that I think Celestite and Celestial Lineage did right in terms of diversifying what they do as a band.
Interesting, because I've kind of feel the opposite way, because, like, again, I kind of prefer a different spectrum of black metal, where, like,
mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily like something that is a bit more straightforward, and I prefer the more gimmicky sound, and I found this song to be kind of plain, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not gonna... I don't have any counter-argument to that. It's plain. Like, I love it, but it's very much kind of straightforward Wolves in the Throne Room, Agalaki, Cascadian black metal. Yeah.
For some reason, I was never able to get into, like, super plain black metal.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that, I always need a gimmick. I guess that's true of me, for, like, death metal as well. Like, I don't like straight-up death metal. I always want some sort of either progressive or technical or whatever mm-hmm. kind of gimmick.
Just something going on.
Yeah.
That's, like,
yeah,
different from the norm.
Yeah, because, like, yeah, the difference from the norm. Because, like, I don't know, to me, the best thing a song could do is surprise me, I guess. And, like, I mm-hmm. want that kind of to be preserved. I don't know, whatever. It's a pointless discussion. Well, you can still surprise someone with music and be kind of bad. So I want to talk about the new Humanity's Last Breath song.
Ooh, that was a good segue.
Yeah.
That was good.
So this one, I'm on and off with Humanity's Last Breath. Like, I liked their first stuff when it was like Viljarda but heavier. But then the more they kind of leaned into the tropes of djent and deathcore, the less I started to like them. And this one is kind of like almost like a joke song to me. Like, I can't take the song seriously because there's no momentum to the song. It's just low chugs, like super low chugs trying to be heavy, or like some weird noises, but it doesn't come together in an interesting way like Viljarda does, or like in an avant-garde way like Gorguts say does. Like, it's just like the musical equivalent of trolling to me. This is, I actually feel really negatively about this song. I don't know what you think.
Okay. I've never been the biggest fan of Humanity's Last Breath. Mm-hmm. I thought there was some cool stuff on the first album.
Same, yeah.
And I thought the second EP was just, I'm not a sludge wave guy,
mm-hmm.
other than like a few Black Tongue songs here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Humanity's Last Breath going in a more sludge wave direction didn't really hold my interest at all. And mm-hmm. this new song just kind of, it reminds me of like Holy War, the Thy Art Is Murder album, more than anything else. In terms of just being a not good combination of like grim, dark black metal and like low heavy chugs.
Yeah. Well, it's really, there is no flow to the song. That's my main problem with it.
Like, yeah, absolutely. That's, yeah, like on a moment to moment level, it's just, you know, da 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 da.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
It's just like, you know, it completely stopped.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to kind of work into a groove.
And like, you could do some interesting things with that, but they don't.
The song's called Abyssal Mouth, by the way. Meshuggah's made a career out of doing that.
Yeah, pretty much. Or, well, I'm completely blanking, but there are bands that do that. Fuck me.
I'd say yeah. Cytotoxin does that on the new album.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. Arspire does that a lot, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Like, their whole sound is based on kind of stop-go real fast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is just, like,
The pauses are too long.
Yeah, they're too long, and, like, they're... Random isn't a right word, but, like, they're kind of intentionally awkward, I feel like.
Yes.
And that just kind of, like, doesn't come together in an interesting way. It comes together in a stupid way.
Mm-hmm. And also the kind of, like, frontier-y guitar and noise squeals just don't work.
Yep.
They're not abrasive enough. They don't sound heavy enough.
Yeah, it just sounds stupid. Yeah. And the production is like way too produced.
Yeah, which is weird because like Buster is a really, really good producer.
Yeah, he's done a good job on like Born of Osiris and a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. But like this is kind of again like not only is the song kind of like a meme of modern deathcore, the production is also kind of like a meme of modern deathcore. Like, it's like tropey as fuck in a not good way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, more to the other end of the spectrum, there's a new song from Celeste, Set Chute Brutale.
There's so much fucking music to talk about.
Yeah, right?
There's so much.
So,
it's beautiful.
Are you familiar with this band? I was unfamiliar with them until this.
I actually was pretty unfamiliar with them.
Oh.
And I didn't really know anything about them. I sent you, when we were talking about doing the podcast, I sent you a Facebook message saying, who is Celeste? because I just didn't know. And completely unfamiliar, but I went into the song and I was very pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe it? I have a hard time kind of nailing it down. Kind of blackened, kind of... Yeah.
I would just call it extreme metal.
Yeah, true. It's sometimes like, I think
that's,
hard
that's
to kind
the of... closest to a... The closest of a descriptor as I think you could get. Because it's so fluidly in between different things.
Yeah. And they're a French band, and their album Infidels is coming out August 21st, and this song is a trip. It's like heaviness, abrasiveness, but in a kind of warm, black metal-y way, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And the video is just like in darkness with red flashing lights behind them, the band members playing in a kind of artistic fashion. Really strong. So if you're into any of the things that we just said, including red lights, I guess, go
band's
listen to
playing
this.
Artistically.
Yeah, there you go. So go check out Celeste, I guess.
I would compare them. I would say like the immediate comparison that came to mind was like Rorqual.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of doing that very, very black metal-y, but also death metal-y, but also sludge metal-y, but also kind of post-y.
Yes. Yeah.
Style. And I'd say if you're a fan of like Rorqual or in general, any of kind of the things that we've discussed related to Celeste, like,
mm-hmm.
They're worth the time to check out.
Definitely. So, that's that. Oh, also, I forgot to put this on the agenda, but presumably you've listened to this, but there's two new Convert songs.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of Converge. Are you?
I think... Oh, boy. All right. I think they're pretty overrated. I have always felt that Converge is a band that has some incredibly good songs,
mm-hmm.
but on the whole is very, very overrated and very, very meat and potatoes.
Yeah. I can agree. You're not going to find any argument for me here. They're talented dudes, but like I feel like their shtick is... they're good at their shtick, but their shtick is just not that interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, they put out, like I said, you know, they have some great songs, like The Saddest Day, Concubine, Dark mm-hmm. Horse. Those are the only three that immediately come to mind, but and all three of those are album openers, I just realized. So maybe that says more about my attention span than Converge. But they have some songs that I really like, but overall, I think kind of, you know, they do, yeah, they, you know, they have a hammer and everything's a nail.
Yeah. And I mean, the people in the band themselves are very influential in the scene. You know, Kurt Ballou produces. Mm-hmm.
Jacob, he's an amazing producer. I love, he's like, as far as producers go, he's like far and away one of my favorites. And seeing that he produced something is basically an indicator that I will like it.
Except for his own band, I guess.
Except for Converge, yeah.
Jacob Bannon is, you know, he does art for a lot of stuff. And Ben Kohler also, what was he, Mutoid Man, Killer Be yes. Killed.
Yeah, Ben Kohler is a really good drummer.
Yeah.
Mutoid Man is incredible.
So, yeah, I guess then that's kind of how you feel about the new singles as well?
So...
They're two very different songs, by the way.
They're, yeah, I think my opinion on the first song, on...
Which one?
I can tell you, I can tell you about T-Pain. that one is, again, it's like an okay meat and potatoes Converge track. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that people think it's amazing is because Converge has starved their fans almost as much as Winter Sun has.
Yeah. Woo!
And, we gotta throw Winter Sun in somehow. But that's kind of how I feel about that. And that's not to, you know, that's gonna ruffle some feathers that I've said that, but...
Yeah.
You know, like, no ill will to anyone who likes those songs. Like, that song goes hard. It's just, like, it's just another Converge song.
Yeah.
Eve, just, it's like a really boring post-metal song.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I've seen people kind of say, you know, it's a step in the right direction for the band. It's newer, it's more experimental. And,
for
like,
the
okay,
band,
sure.
Maybe.
It's, yeah, like, sure, for the band. But, like, it's just not, I don't know. It's a curveball in their discography.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, if I'm gonna listen to Eve, I might as well go listen to, like...
Literally anything else?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
I might as well go listen... See, Converge has made me sick now. I might as well go listen to, like, countless other post-metal bands
yeah.
that have, you know, done the exact same thing they do there, but just
I think this kind
better.
Of happens with a lot of very beloved bands that go on for a while, and hot take here, Meshuggah is, I think, in the same boat.
Yeah. I agree with that.
So, yeah, but I mean, I guess if their fans like it, then hey, more power to them. I'm not a fan, so this is gonna be like the one Converge song that converts me, right? So, like, I mean, for me, like, everything that they have to say has already been said, and I'm not interested in that's okay. So, yeah.
That's yeah. It's like, you know, if people like it, power to them. Good on you for being able to enjoy something. but like. Overall,
sorry, you
I
have
just
bad
don't
taste.
Really think it's... Yeah, sorry. Our apologies. I can't really see either of these songs changing my opinion on the band.
Yeah, which is fine. You know, not every song has to be for everyone. You know. Okay, that kind of covers the news.
Actually, speaking of new music, did you listen to the new August Burns Red song?
Oh, yeah, thanks for reminding me. Or... Yeah, no. I listened to it and I forgot about it.
That says enough right there, I think.
I am a huge August Burns Red fan. Like, Found in Faraway Places is, like, probably in my top 10, 20 favorite albums. And
yeah.
I fucking love that album. And by the way, in a couple of weeks, Messengers is going to be 10 years old.
Holy shit.
Yeah, fuck. But the new song
That's
is...
older than I am.
The new song is just completely forgettable. I don't remember its name. I remember that it has a lot of chugging and then, like, whatever. Okay.
Yeah, it's, I listened to it in preparation for mm-hmm. doing this podcast. It was like, oh, you know, Nan is a fan of August yeah. Burns Red. Like, I listened to Found in Faraway Places and,
yeah.
you know, I wouldn't say it didn't strike the same chord with me that it did for you, but I, mm-hmm. you know, it's a great album nonetheless. Like, I can just... Objectively, it is a good album.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that. And then this new song, I listened to it.
Invisible Enemy, by the way, is the new
song. Invisible Enemy.
Yeah.
I spaced out while listening to it and forgot that I was listening to it. So I think that says something about it right there. It's like the last 2 minutes are one chug riff.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really disappointing.
So,
but I don't know. There's this whole trend of bands like putting out their worst song as their first single.
Yeah, I think it's the most kind of crowd pleasing song. Like August Burns Red kind of do that. Like their most, the song that they think is going to make the most live play with the bro audience, they usually put out first. Mm-hmm. And this is kind
also
of along
the
lines.
That'll be the most fun in the, like, that'd be a really fun song in a live setting.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, it's always good to put out songs, because then, I don't know if they're going on tour anytime soon, but if they go on tour to promote the album and say it's not out yet, they can, you know, play that song and people will know it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not, like, a interesting or, like, emotional song. Like, to me, Found in Faraway Places is great because, like, every song is kind of its own thing, and they are all cool. They have their own thing that they do, and also, like, the lyrics are really strong. Whereas this one's kind of like whatever, like it's fine. It's a song that could have been on their debut, like the one before Messengers, and it would have fit in there, but like not with current day August Burns Red, where they've diversified their sound so much.
Absolutely.
All right. So any other like last minute drops?
Nothing I can think of at the moment.
Okay, that's fine. So, normally here, what we do is, like, we either have, like, a segment with Eden, or we just go into Cool People Time, and Cool People Time, as you know, is just, like, we discuss, like, non-music, non-metal stuff.
Alright.
But if you want to have a segment, like, talk about an album that you particularly love, like, you know, highlight an underrated release, or return to an album that you loved or something, we could do that. But otherwise, we can move on to Cool People.
I guess the one thing that I'm really stoked on at the moment, and this is going back to the, you know, the white supremacist math rock, is the new Terra Melos is putting out a new album on August 25th. They put out a single for it. Don't Say I Don't Know.
I think we might have discussed that on the podcast at some point. I'm not sure.
Maybe. I'm not sure. I think it came out either.
Oh, it's too new. So no, I'm wrong. Yeah. I'm wrong.
Okay. But they are a great band, have a pretty great track record, and it's a good song. So anyone who's kind of, and it's very accessible. So I think anyone who's kind of wanted to, like, heard the name Terra Melos or maybe saw them, they were just on tour with Chan and Covet and Little Tybee recently. Anyone who maybe caught that tour and didn't know who they were and was blown away by their set because they're amazing. Should check out Don't Say I Don't Know and get excited for the album Trash Generator, because it's a very good, I got the promo recently and I've listened to it all the way through a few times, and it's a very good primer on their sound as a band. In terms of taking their weird experimental stuff and putting it into manageable packages inside of really fun, summery, dancey, light, poppy math rock songs.
Okay, yeah, that's
so that's
good.
Yeah, it's really good. Check it out if you feel up to it. But yeah, people, go listen to Don't Say I Don't Know and get stoked on Trash Generator.
Along those lines, I guess I have the promo for the new Acrocolk album.
Ooh.
I think it's called Renaissance and Extremis. Yes. And it is very cool. I can just say that. It comes out next month, apparently, and as in August. So it's basically like they never left. It's really good. Like, the production is fine. It's not like it's not too modernized or too old school. You have the weird vocals, the kind of pseudo jazzy avant-garde. Like, it's just a really cool album that only they can make, and I'm very happy with how it is. Like, there's already a single out, Disappear, but that's, you know, not the best that the album has to offer. So yeah, get excited.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm really stoked on that album. This is gonna be good, because they were kind of a band that left
before
they made their waves way before I got into metal, and kind of left the scene before I got into metal, and so I kind of heard them mentioned here and there, but never in the light of a band I should be super stoked on. So I'm excited for this album, because it's going to give me a good chance to get into them in you know, new material.
Yeah. For me, Akakok was like, when I was getting into metal, there were always this thing that is like way too much for me. And I always kind of like looked up to that, right? I was like, one day I'm going to get into this and then that's going to be a good day. And then I got into them, but obviously they kind of stopped being a thing. So now them being back is very exciting to me. Like I love Words That Go Unspoken and Antichrist. So like it is very exciting to me that there are things
we hear. Heavy Blog love the Antichrist. You heard it here, folks.
Ooh. And also White Supremacist Math Rock.
Yeah, 666. Hail Stan.
Okay, so is there any non-music thing that you've been into lately that you want to talk about?
Watching the Emoji Movie and the like reactions to the Emoji Movie has been like absolutely incredible. And I know that's kind of, you know, that's the hot meme right now is talking about the Emoji Movie.
Have you actually seen it or?
I have not seen it. Well, I mean, keep in mind, I was, you know, out of the country for 10 days prior to this.
Yeah. Well, I was in Hawaii for a week, so I was also kind of away.
Yeah. So I haven't had a chance to, I was just chilling out in Montreal and Quebec with my family. Didn't really, or I guess Quebec City. Didn't really have a chance to see the Emoji Movie, thank God. I kind of want to see it a lot. And I realize that that's just feeding the cycle of, you know, garbage begetting garbage.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's so incredible. Like, I want to see how bad it can possibly be.
Yeah, I know that feeling. I saw Transformers 5.
Ooh.
Yeah, I have no intention in, like, paying to see it. Maybe if it drops on Netflix one day, I'll be like, what the fuck is this? Let's just check it out.
But, yeah.
I saw Sausage Party like that. Like, it was on Netflix, and I was like, you know what? Fuck it. And it was okay. Like, it wasn't as bad as it was. Like, the thing is, like, with Sausage Party, it was, like, not as... So, like, you know, it's... It could be bad, but like in a hilarious train wreck way, or it could be like
wasn't even bad.
Yeah, or it could be extremely offensive, or what? Like it just wasn't anything. Right? It was just like a basically an animated movie with a lot of swearing, but like okay, yeah.
Yeah, like, it was. I read the script the day it leaked. Not really sure why. Wasn't sure why at the time. Still not sure why. But I read the script of Sausage Party the day that it leaked on the internet, and yeah, it seemed so completely average, and that it would basically hit all of the marks for like a, you know, kind of post James Franco Seth Rogen movie.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I like some of Seth Rogen's stuff. You know, like Pineapple Express is fun. Superbad's really good.
Yeah, Superbad is amazing. You know,
he's definitely in good things, but I don't know. Him and James Franco just are terrible influences on each other and kind of bring out the worst in each other's performances, in my opinion. And
yeah, that makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, I've kind of lost interest in seeing anything he does.
Like James Franco together now. James Franco is a legit great actor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and also he's like, he has six degrees.
He's a great actor.
He has like six degrees. Like, and he teaches, like, that is ridiculous. But like, yeah, with Seth Rogen, it's like, he like does his lowest effort material. That being said, I am very excited for The Disaster Artist.
Yeah, that is actually a movie that is both of the minute that I'm extremely excited for.
Yeah. Have you read the book or listened to the audiobook?
I have not read the book, but I've read a lot about the book. I've read interviews with Greg Sestero. You know, I've seen The Room plenty of times.
Yeah. Dude, you have to listen to the audiobook. It is amazing. Like, Greg Sestero does a great job of narrating it, and he has an incredible Tommy Wiseau impression. Like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that.
It's like... actually really surprising to read because like you get an kind of an insight into like Tommy Wiseau's psyche, and like he's like obviously he's a crazy person, but also like there's something very human about him that sometimes comes out, and it's like really interesting to see mm-hmm. because like the book is about as much as Tommy Wiseau as it is about the making of the room.
Because yeah, those things the two are so inextricable.
Yeah. So it is like, because the book kind of like goes back and forth, like every other chapter is present tense, the making of the room. And then it goes back to how Greg met Tommy and how their relationship developed. So it goes back and forth between these like two timelines. And it's actually like really well put together and really interesting to see. And like Greg Sestero is a great narrator and like he's also a great reader. Like it's just amazing.
I'll have to read that then. Wow.
Well, especially listen to it because like in audio, it just takes, in fact, you could go to audibletrial.com/heavy to get a free audiobook and this can be that book. Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. I don't think I've used the Audible Heavy blog trial yet. Somehow. And, yeah, that, and I was watching, someone made a like scene to scene comparison of James Franco as Tommy Wiseau and like Tommy mm-hmm. Wiseau's actual performance in the room. In his Tommy Wiseau accent, like it's not spot on, but it's really good.
Yeah.
Like he clearly studied for a while to get that accent down. Like he put a lot of work into that and like that has made me more excited for the movie.
And Tommy is involved with the movie. Like he's producing mm-hmm. it or something. And he allowed the movie to be made in condition that he will be in it at some point.
Thank God.
But like one other thing that gives me confidence is the movie is produced by A24 Productions. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but A24 have been killing it. So let me read to you a list of movies that A24 have done.
Please.
Enemy by Denis Villeneuve, who does Arrival and the new Blade Runner and Sicario, which is one of my favorite movies. Under the Skin, which had Scarlett Johansson playing a really weird avant-garde role. Lock, which had Tom Hardy. Basically a movie that has only Tom Hardy in it, and he's like a driver. What else? They had Ex Machina, which is one of the best AI movies out there. They have The Witch, which is, a really cool horror movie from last year.
They clearly have a really, really good record.
Yeah, The Green Room, which was another amazing horror. Are you familiar with Green Room?
I think I'm confusing it with some Eli Roth movie that was like also the Green something.
Green Inferno. Yeah, no, Green Room is really cool. It has Patrick Stewart in it. Basically, this punk band.
Is he reprising his role as the poop emoji?
No, God damn.
Well, now I'm not interested.
This punk band goes to play a show at a venue in the middle of nowhere, and they play Nazi Punk's Fuck Off, and it's in Portland. And turns out that the venue is full of skinheads, and they decide to trap these guys and hunt them down slowly. And it's a really interesting movie. It's Cody's favorite movie from last year. We discussed it on the podcast. It's a really cool movie. I recommend it.
I gotta watch that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, and The Lobster, which I watched on a plane like last week, I wanted to talk about it. The Lobster has Colin Farrell, and it's a semi-sci-fi movie. Basically, it takes place in this world where like single people are hunted down, and they're put through this hotel where in 45 days, unless they fall in love and get married, they're turned forcibly into an animal. And it's this like dystopian society, and Colin Farrell is this guy who goes to the hotel to find like a relationship. And it's like a really weird dark comedy, I guess. And Colin Farrell is great in it. I would definitely recommend it. I can't say much more about it.
It's a really cool premise, yeah.
It's a really weird premise done really well. Like it's very awkward. Like in this society, people don't know how to do social interaction because like love is this commodity, right? So people don't know how to do like small talk, and like being single is kind of frowned upon. So like people don't know how to do courtship.
Mm-hmm.
So people kind of group together by common characteristics and like, okay, now we have a relationship and now we are a productive member of society. Like it's a really interesting, weird movie.
That sounds really cool. That sounds like have you heard any George Saunders? He's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's one of my favorite modern artists, or not artists, authors.
Yeah,
he's an artist, but whatever. He's one of my favorite modern authors.
Mm-hmm.
And that premise, kind of that weird quasi sci-fi, kind of very oddball premise. Sounds exactly like something he would make a story out of. So that's piqued my interest.
Yeah, it's a really interesting movie and it's shot really well as well.
Excellent.
And from this year, they had It Comes at Night, which is a pretty interesting horror movie, and A Ghost Story, which is, again, like a really interesting... Like, the thing is, they make all these movies that are, like, take a very straightforward premise and then turn it into something really cerebral and interesting. So A24 is a great production house, and that they're backing The Disaster Artist gives me a lot of confidence, because, to my knowledge, they haven't had a single dud. So I'm really excited.
I doubt this will be the first.
Yeah.
Given, you know, how much care. There's a lot of, like, love going into this movie, which sounds really weird.
Yeah.
To say about something in relation to The Room, but there's just so much love going into The Disaster Artist.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's made by people who clearly, like, want to tell the story of how The Room was made.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, obviously it's like, oh, The Room, like, this is funny, but it seems really genuine. Like, they're trying to actually figure out, or not figure out so much as just, like, they're trying to actually tap into and unpack the phenomenon that is The Room.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, if you read or listen to The Disaster Artist, that kind of also weirdly applies to The Room itself. Like, Tommy Wiseau was incredibly earnest about making this movie. Like, he put everything into this movie to the point of, like, you know, being way too into it and, like, being actively harmful to people close to him. But, like, that is exactly the amount of care you should put in. Like, it's not... This movie shouldn't be made because The Room is a meme. It should be made because The Room is just a very interesting part of history.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, from everything that we've seen so far, it looks as though the people behind this movie realize that.
Yeah. Like, I just noticed Hannibal Buress is in this movie. Didn't know that.
Yes, he is. That, I mean, why do you think I'm excited?
He was great in Spider-Man, by the way. Like, his little role.
That's really good to hear. I haven't seen I don't really care much for superhero movies. That's my dark
secret. Yeah, I watch them. I watch all of them, but I also don't care about them, if that makes sense. Like, I will not lose myself if I don't get to see one, but I guess like participating in the conversation. And I like blockbuster movies, I guess, as much as I like hipster indie movies. So yeah.
I don't know. I feel like it's not that they're not worth the time, but I just feel like they all go in the same direction and they blend together and, you know, they don't really they don't deviate enough. I don't think any of them deviate enough from the standard formula. Besides what genre they're fundamentally rooted in.
Yeah,
for
sure.
That's not enough of a deviation from each one for me to kind of really, really enjoy them. And there's a few of them that I love. Like, I don't know if these technically count, but the first two Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies are amazing. Guardians of the Galaxy is really good. And, you know, even though there's definitely things you can critique about it, both as a movie and from a more social point of view, I thought Ant-Man was pretty well done as well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't stay up to date on movies, and superhero movies are kind of the big casualty of that.
Yeah, that's fair. For me, I kind of have like two movie watching modes. There's the mode where I watch kind of the cerebral independent movie, and then there's the mood with which I watch the blockbuster movie, and I can like separate those two. Like, I don't necessarily hold them to the same standard, so I don't mind like having a good time at the movies, I guess.
Yeah, with
the
blockbuster. Yeah, and I don't want to sound like I like, you know, I don't hate fun at all. Like,
it's fine.
You know, they're fun movies. It's just like,
they're pointless for the most part, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like just eating a bag of chips.
Yeah, exactly. pretty much. That's the analogy. Yep. But I always try to highlight like more interesting movies. I wish I had a movie podcast, honestly. I love talking about movies, but I don't have anyone to talk about them with.
You just talk about them by yourself.
Good. Well, actually, just, Cody is probably good. Cody is actually like really into movies, and like we gel a lot. We did an episode of the podcast with him, and it was really cool. But nice. You know, it's a matter of kind of priorities.
Yeah.
Shout out to Cody.
Shout out to Cody.
All right, I guess we could end it on that note.
I mean, I don't really have
video games.
Anything else to? I've been replaying Bloodborne,
mm-hmm.
and I forgot how absolutely brilliant the starting area, Central Yharnam, is.
Yep.
I could gush about Bloodborne and about the Souls series in general for hours. But
Bloodborne is probably in my top five favorite games of all time.
I would say so. I would agree with that. I think, okay, Bloodborne with the DLC
is in my top
five favorite games of all time. Because the DLC, I think, unlike the other Souls games, which are, you know, the DLC is cool, but they're a fairly complete package on their own.
Yeah.
Bloodborne is not complete without the DLC because of how much the difficulty scales off towards the end of the game.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a combination of, like, you just get good at the game, and so you kind of don't really have to worry nearly as much about average enemies.
Yeah.
But, like, the quote-unquote last two bosses, by which I mean Mikalash and the Wet Nurse,
mm-hmm.
are really, really bad.
Mikalash is fucking annoying.
Mikalash is... I get what they were going for, and it's cool that he's, like, a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, he's just fucking annoying, and the fact that his, you know, his running is... I think it's just RNG... except for in a couple places, and like the fact that his running is just completely RNG is just so aggravating, because you can spend like 10 minutes just fucking around.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it just, and you know, he only has two moves on top of that, one of which is almost like an automatic instant kill. And it's just not a fun fight. And then the Wet Nurse is just
not that hard.
And I can't tell if it's the music, or if it's how slow she moves, or what, but there's no urgency to the fight.
Yeah.
Like, you just kind of sit back, you wait for her to use her attacks, which are really, really, have, like, telegraphs that are each, like, 2 years
It feels like
long.
A Dark Souls 1 boss.
It feels like an early game Dark Souls 1 boss.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I guess, you know, there's Garmin and the Moon Presence after that, and, you know, those are both pretty... Garmin's great, and the Moon Presence is, like, pretty decent.
Yeah.
But with how much the end game of the main game kind of falls off, the DLC and the DLC bosses are, I think, a pretty necessary
amazing.
Addition.
Like, Maria...
Oh, my God. Absolutely amazing. Maria is amazing.
Ludwig.
Ludwig is my favorite boss in the Soul series.
The Orphan is amazing, and, fuck, even the reskin of the Cleric Beast is amazing. I forget his name.
Yeah, Lawrence.
Lawrence, yeah. Like, that, you would think that it's just gonna be a reskin, but the way they change it adds so much more to the fight, and that's probably one of the hardest fights in the entire series.
Yeah, I'd say Lawrence and the Orphan of Kos are probably...
Yep.
Two of the hardest. The Orphan of Kos is, like, that also, that's kind of, like, a legitimately difficult fight, as opposed to just being, like...
frustratingly difficult.
Yeah, it's not frustrating. It's just really fucking tough.
Like, I kind of, you know, that I don't really love Dark Souls 3, and I feel like some of the bosses in 3 are kind of, well, that's a kind of a catchword, but like artificially difficult, because like they have attack strings that are way too long, and mm-hmm. also they have attacks that have the same roundup that end up differently. So
it's like, how are you supposed to know which it is until it's too late?
Yeah, and also they overuse the trope that the series kind of discovered in Dark Souls 2, where if you dodge, like, the attacks have a hold, so if you dodge too early, you get hit, because, like, mm-hmm. they kind of trick you. And, like, every boss...
Yeah, all the late-game bosses do that in Dark Souls 3.
Yeah, so, like, every boss in Dark Souls 3 being like that kind of put me off of the game, and they're, like, super fast and aggressive, whereas Orphan of Kos... is also fast and aggressive, but it's a much better done fight, I think.
Yeah. And it's kind of crazy that the people who did Dark Souls, I mean, I know you and I have our disagreements on Dark Souls 2 and where it sits in the series, but the fact that the people that did Dark Souls 2 also did the Old Hunters really kind of gives me hope for the game they're doing in the future, which I'm assuming is the like dark medieval fantasy game that From is one of the three games that From is currently working on.
Yeah, hopefully.
And I think the other one they're working on, I heard that it probably is Armored Core. So that's cool.
Yeah, Armored Core is cool. I would be very interested in seeing that formula applied to Armored Core, honestly. That would probably piss off Armored Core fans, but I think that series is due for a shakeup, honestly.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's kind of needs to be pulled kicking and screaming into where video games are at now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bloodborne is amazing. Yeah.
What have you been playing recently?
Two things. Pyre, which is the new game by Supergiant Games, who made Transistor and Bastion. And it's a really interesting, like, have you played either of those games?
I have played both of those games, but I don't think I've finished. I finished Transistor, I didn't finish Bastion.
Okay, you know how they kind of have a similar vibe, but are also pretty different?
Yeah.
This one is even further so. So basically the premise is that you're like exiled and you have a band of friends, and the game has two modes. It's either a visual novel where you know these characters talk and you kind of make decisions and kind of side with one of them, and those kind of give you some different stats and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then in between those is a minigame, no, not minigame, a game that is halfway between Transistor's combat and basketball. So, basically, it's a team game. Each side has three characters and a pyre, which is their kind of goal, right? And there is a ball, which is like a celestial orb or whatever, that you basically have to grab and then dunk into their pyre. And every time you dunk it, it deals some damage to their pyre, and when their pyre health reaches zero, the round is over. And, like, every character has different abilities, a different moveset, and, like, a bunch of mechanics. And it's really interesting and incredibly satisfying to play. So, like, the combat, I didn't think I would be into, like, a sportsy game, but it's actually really well done and kind of evokes their previous games in some ways. So I really dig it. And the art style is amazing. The world building is,
That's always kind of, you know, the big thing about Supergiant is the gameplay is good, but the world building and the artistic direction are kind of really the what you come for at first.
Yeah. So in that sense, like, this game is super, super amazing, and I'm really happy with it. I'm sure I like it more than Bastion. I don't know if I like it more than Transistor yet, but it is entirely likely that by the time I'm finished, I might be there.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but also, doesn't Pyre have a competitive online mode?
Local multiplayer.
Okay, local multiplayer.
Yeah.
That's like something entirely new. And I heard that before I knew anything about the game. And I was really confused.
Yeah. I wish it was online, but I guess they don't have the infrastructure to support that.
I wonder if they'll add that in future updates, maybe depending on the
popularity.
Based on the popularity of Pyre, if they'll kind of set up some sort of online, like, P2P.
I would be interested in seeing that, because the combat has a lot of depth. Like, every character is, like, completely different in terms of how fast they are, how big they are, how much... every character has an aura under their feet, which is like this kind of circle that your character projects around them. And if someone touches that, they die. And, like, you can shoot a ray, like, you can expend your aura to shoot a ray to hit someone. Like, there's a lot of tactics to it, and it's, like, really interesting and really well done. So, yeah, I would definitely be interested. But there is, like, a endless mode and, like, a local multiplayer mode, but an online multiplayer mode would really pick up, I think, and, like, take off. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'm playing is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Oh, my God. What a game. It's... You run around for 15 minutes collecting stuff, and then you die in 2 seconds.
But it's actually a well-done version of that formula. Like, I don't know if you ever played...
Oh, yeah, I love it. That's not a criticism. That's, like, why it's fun.
Like, when in DayZ...
In a weird way.
You will run around for 50 minutes, not find anything, and then die of diarrhea or get shot from 2 kilometers away. Whereas in this one, it's actually exciting. And especially, it's really cool to play with friends. Like... This weekend, for the first time, I played it with friends, and it was a completely different experience from playing it solo.
It's a game that I personally would be infuriated by if I ever took it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Same.
But when you just kind of goof around with friends and you don't, you know, take, like, you kind of, you play it well and, like, you're kind of playing to win, but you're also, you know, just goofing around and, like, having fun with it.
Not tryharding.
Not being, like, super tryhard. It kind of, you get these amazing moments. I remember I was playing with a few friends one time, and we had just dropped into an area, and someone had gotten there a little before us.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a gun and was shooting at all of us, and my friend yells over the mic, like over the in-game voice chat, he's like, wait, don't shoot, we're here to respect women. And this guy, like, turns on his mic and gasps and is like, go, before my teammates get here. And, like, let us go. And it's just, like, moments like that are just hilarious.
The one thing happened yesterday was, like, I was playing with Ren, and, like, he enters this building and he knows there's at least two guys there because he shoots someone and they get knocked out, but they don't die. So clearly they have a friend. So he goes upstairs and turns out that they're on the roof and they are kind of, it's basically the roof from the room, right? And, like, they're both camped facing the door. My friend just walks out and shoots both of them and kills them, even though they're, like, fully, like, turned towards the door, looking at the door and expecting him. He somehow, like, gets both of them, and it's like, what the fuck just happened here? Like, how did I survive that? How did they not shoot me? And, like, yeah, other times I will have, like, it was, like, the circle was, like, incredibly small. I don't know if you know this, like, underground bunker in the middle of the map. But, like, we were we were there, and like, basically what's happening is that the circle is shrinking so that we will have to leave the bunker because the bunker is going to be left out of the circle.
Yeah.
So we're, like, running out, and there's, like, five people outside. I just run out and, like, with a automatic shotgun, just gun down three people. And then, like, we get stuck at the entrance of the tunnel, like, we're four people group ourselves, and, like, we just get mowed down because, like, we're all coming out of the same tunnel, and they just, like, one person just mows down all of us because, like, we're just sitting ducks right there. It was pretty, pretty amazing. Like,
yeah, it's a game that kind of, there's a lot of downtime, and there's a lot of just kind of running around not doing anything, but when it kind of builds into these really, really great moments, it's, you know, it's a fantastic.
And even time. The downtime doesn't feel like downtime because it's tense, because, like, you don't know where.
Absolutely. It's like, it's building tension.
Yeah. So it's, and also I really like how fast the matchmaking is. Like, you immediately get into a game, and yeah, that's pretty great.
Apparently, yeah, and so I think, like, that I'm sure that has most, that's mostly just to do with how popular it's become.
Well, yeah, it's sold over 6 million copies and is, like, has 500,000 concurrent players. So yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I agree. The fast matchmaking is really a boon.
Yep. All right, cool. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thanks for coming on, Simon. And goodbye.
Thanks, everyone.